The Round with Richard Kaufman.
Over the next 10 weeks, you'll get an insight into the world of golf and what it takes to be a top-level sportsman and woman. This is The Round with myself, Richard Kaufman.
Saturday, November the 20th, 1976.
This week, the story of one of golf's original teen sensations. Del Hayes is well known now as a TV broadcaster, but back in the 1970s, he burst onto the world golf scene. By the age of 28, though, he turned his back on professional golf. In this interview, we talk about the great characters of that era, how South African politics affected him, and, of course, the round. Del chose the 1976 Sportsman Lager PGA Championship on the Sunshine Tour, and I started by asking him how his game was heading into the week.
I wasn't feeling great, to be honest. I'd just finished my first year on the PGA Tour with not that much success. And I came back to South Africa at the end of the year. This was in November. And the good news was that I was playing on a golf course that I'd had some success before. I'd won the same tournament twice in a row before that, beating Gary Player. And for us as South Africans, to beat Gary Player was a big deal. Gary Player was kind of, through the middle 70s, the second best golfer in the world, behind Jack Nicklaus. He'd already won 8 major championships. And he'd won 130, 40, whatever it was, tournaments around the world. And he was very, very special. And obviously South Africa were very proud of him. And for us, when I talk about us, I'm talking about players that like Hugh Bayocchi, John Bland, the Hennings, Harold and Alan Henning and Graham Henning, Dennis Hutchinson, the list goes on. For us, it was a big deal to beat Gary Player. That's what we set our sights on. And Gary always played in the South African Open and the PGA. Gary really, really did support the Sunshine Tour amazingly well. And as I said, I'd beaten him twice in a row. I got to this one and I wasn't playing well. I was driving the ball horrifically, in fact. And the Wanderers Golf Club in Johannesburg is quite a narrow golf course. So it's a golf course that you actually have to drive the ball pretty well. Otherwise, you're just behind any one of millions of trees that they have on the golf course. So I wasn't terribly confident, to be honest.
So here we are. This is now, I make it 6 years into your career, which has been a fantastic career already at this point. You've gone Sunshine Tour. Am I right in saying you won your first event?
That's right.
I mean, that's an incredible achievement, isn't it?
Well, probably unfortunately, the game came quite easy to me. And I'd had a very good amateur career. I turned professional. I won my first tournament in South Africa as a pro. And then I went to the European Tour and won my first tournament on the European Tour as a pro, the Spanish Open.
Why did you say unfortunately? Most people would say that's
well,
a dream.
I had success at a very young age. I was 18 years old and I won the Spanish Open. I was 18 years old and I won the first tournament here in South Africa. So, I was winning at 18. And I really do believe that the very best players, if you go back, have had a period of struggle. There are obviously exceptions. I suppose you could say Tiger was probably an exception. But Tiger was quite a lot older when he got onto the tour. He was sort of 22. Rory would have been the obvious exception. And there are other exceptions. But, to be winning tournaments at the age of 18 is kind of crazy.
Let's put it into perspective, because at that time, you were the youngest winner on the European Tour, and that was a record that lasted 30-plus years. So that gives it that kind of perspective. Did you think about what you were doing at that period? As you say, 18 years of age, I mean, outside of your comfort zone, but snap straight away, trophy in your hands.
I didn't have a clue. I really did not have a clue. I really didn't have a clue how good I was. I didn't have a clue that I was winning at this ridiculous age. I was just playing golf and loving it and loving the life and all was well. All is well if you win. And, when you win, you learn nothing. You only learn from losing in life. And so I wasn't learning anything. I was just playing golf, making money, winning tournaments. The money wasn't anywhere like it was today, but you still lived very well on the money that you made in those days if you were a winner. And, I was just exceptionally lucky. But I had no idea. I thought it was like the norm. I thought everybody was doing it.
So 6 years on now, and we're heading to this, one of the big tournaments in South Africa, the South African PGA Championship. When we come to this final round, are you now a golfer with scars?
Most definitely, because in 1975 I led the European Order of Merit, which again was a very, very big deal. I was the first South African to have done that. Not that that was a big thing, because the genuine European Tour only started in 1972. But
Let's put that into perspective. The year before you, Peter Oosterhuis won.
Correct.
The year after, Seve Ballesteros won. So,
yeah.
Let's not downplay it.
No, sure. But being the first South African, they'd only played it for 4 years. So
now the
South
see.
Africans
okay.
were going to win it.
Fair enough.
But in saying that, you know, we'd had a lot of South Africans that had played on the tour, the Hennings and Dennis Hutchinson and obviously the great Bobby Locke. You know, but the European Tour wasn't won until 1972. But it was a major thing. You know, it got you into the Masters tournament and various other invitations that it got you into. So, you know, I was obviously very proud of that. But then I went to America in 1976, which probably was a mistake, okay? Because although I was now 24 years of age, you know, I probably wasn't as mature as I should have been. And I went over there and it was an exceptionally lonely time. You know, the players didn't mix like they did in Europe. There were only two other South Africans that played on the American Tour at that time, Bobby Cole and Gary Player, and they didn't play that much. They didn't play that often. So a lot of the time, I was kind of on my own. And I really struggled. I struggled from a personal point of view, and I struggled on the golf course. I didn't play very good golf. So 1976 and 1977 were the 2 years that I played in America full-time. Were probably the two hardest years of my life.
When you say you were lonely, I mean, were you just completely isolated, or was it more serious than that?
No, I was having dinner on my own every night. You know, the American players, you know, travelled with their families. So, you know, it was unlikely they were going to ask a guy out to have dinner. You know, you found that they were spread out much more than they were on the European Tour. They stayed at a lot of different hotels. So they didn't mix like I was used to on the European Tour.
Because on the European Tour, you had Simon Hobday at the time, Gavin Levinson, John Bland, Hugh Bajocki. There was a whole... Jeff Hawkes, maybe, was he around that time? I don't know.
Well, he was just starting.
Yeah, so there was a lot of South Africans. So suddenly you're on your own. Do you think was that the key to...
Oh, no question. I really didn't enjoy myself on the American Tour. And it had nothing to do with the American people. It had nothing to do with the golf courses or the golf. It was purely, I was just so lonely playing out there. I really struggled. And as I say, you know, I like to be around people.
Yeah, you're very, I mean, for the, you know, I get to spend a bit of time with Dale. You are one of the most sociable guys I know.
Exactly. And I've always been like that. And I like to be around and in Europe. You know, we would go out, there'd be 10 of us going out for dinner every night. Suddenly I'm in America and I'm a stone on my own. And I didn't enjoy it at all. I really struggled.
There were no laughs.
No laugh. Nobody to laugh with or at you.
And what about your family? Because I mean, we'll come to your dad and his role and everything in your career. But where were your family? They couldn't come at all?
Or? Everybody was in South Africa. You know, America was a long way away. You know, my dad came over to watch me play at the Masters and stuff like that. But it was for the odd tournament. Obviously, they were all working, so it wasn't a case of that. You know, it's not like today where, you know, you can get around so much more quickly and you can get around much more often and you're making the kind of money that allowed you to do that. You know, those days, it wasn't a case of I could pack up my family and just bring them all over to travel with me on tour. You couldn't do that.
So November 1976 now, you're back in South Africa. It kind of must have been a relief to be back amongst your family, your literal family, and also your golfing family.
It certainly was. It was good to be back. It was good to be back on a golf course that I'd had some success on. It was good to be back in a tournament that I'd had some success on. I was really excited to be played in the PGA again. But in saying that, I mean, I wasn't playing the kind of golf where I expected, never mind to win, even to do well.
So why have you chosen this round? You've got a number of choices. You know, as you mentioned, you won first time out on the Sunshine Tour, European Tour. You'd beaten Gary Player before head-to-head this you know, god of South African golf. Why this particular round then?
Well, let's go back to the previous year. I won that tournament 3 years in a row, and that was our premier event in those days. It was the biggest tournament in South Africa and the best tournament in South Africa. You know, the South African Open obviously was also a terrific tournament, but the PGA always had the best field. You know, they brought in a lot of international players to play. You know, we had winners of the PGA like Tom Weisskopf and Hale Irwin and Corey Pavin. We had Tony Jacklin who played. We had Nick Faldo and Sebi Ballesteros. And, you know, so we had the best players playing in that event. You know, I just felt that to win that event, you had to play your best golf. And I'd managed the previous two times. I'd played terrific golf. The previous year, I shot 62 in the third round and I think 66 in the last round, you know, to win quite easily. The year before that, I'd beaten Gary Player by birdie in the last hole, and I'd beaten him. So, you know, I felt great, but I'd played really good golf. I'll never forget the second year that I won. I'll never forget Lee Trevino coming down to watch me hit my tee shot on the first tee, because I was just driving the ball, you know, really, really well. And you know, I don't know whether it was a bit of gamesmanship or whatever, but he came down to the tee to watch me. And after I hit it, he said to me, as I was walking off the tee, he said to me, "My boy," he said, "you're playing too good for us," you know. And
what a compliment.
It was a big compliment. And, you know, that's the sort of golf I was playing in winning it the first two times.
About 76?
It was a different ball game, because now I was hitting the ball all over the world. I mean, what did David Ferrante say? If they'd wrapped my golf ball in bacon, even Lassie couldn't find it. But, you know, it's kind of a parkland golf course that's quite wide open, but it's got tons of trees. So every hole is tree-lined. So if you don't hit the ball straight, you're up against some trees. Anyway, I get to the final round, and somehow I'm a couple of shots ahead of Gary. And
so is it two balls, just you and Gary?
I'm playing with Gary, no, three of us, Gary Player and a guy called Kirby Lagrange. Now, Kirby won the British Masters twice. So another guy who could seriously play golf. Kirby was a few more shots behind us. So by the time we get round to the sort of 14th, 15th hole, it's Gary and I. And I mean, I am just hitting recovery shot after recovery shot, holding putts, chipping and putting, you know, coming out the bunkers and holding the putts for pars and stuff. And I got to the 16th hole, and I've just got my nose in front. And I get to the 16th hole, and I hit my tee shot out to the right into the trees. And I hit this low shot under the trees, up the hole sort of tilts from right to left. And it kind of comes in from the right-hand side and runs down onto the green. You know, a miracle shot. You know, I had no margin for error. And it's, you know, a sort of a four-iron shot I've had. And I managed to two-putt from sort of 40 feet for a par. Whew, another hole gone. You know, now I've only got two holes left. And I'm one shot ahead of Gary. And on the 17th hole, Gary hits a putt. It's a par three. And Gary hits a putt that goes in the hole like this and spins out. How it came out, I'll never know. It was going so slowly. I mean, I don't know how it missed. Anyway, I've got one hole left, and I'm one shot ahead. And the 18th, I duck hook my drive, and I'm right behind a tree. Gary hits a beautiful tee shot. Gary hits the most beautiful second shot, 20 feet past the hole. It's an uphill par four. And I get to my ball, and I'm right behind this sort of bushy tree. And I've got to aim my second shot out on the 10th fairway. And I've literally got to hit a duck hook to bring it back over the crowd, to bring it back onto the fairway. And I hit the shot, and I duck hook it, and it comes back onto the fairway. But I'm still 20, 30 yards short of the green. And Gary's 20 foot past the hole. And I'm sure I've never been quite so nervous in my life. Another thing you've got to understand about South Africa at that time is that we didn't have television. 1976, South Africa had no television. Okay, we just started test programs.
But there was nothing at all.
Nothing.
I never knew that.
We just started test programs. We went straight into colour television. The first television we got in South Africa was colour. We had no black and white television. Okay, you could joke about that.
But we'll come to politics a bit later, but let's not do that now.
So,
for that reason, I take it the crowds are huge.
The crowds are massive.
I mean, okay. Give us a rough, 10,000, 20,000, 5,000?
I would guess. Well, when I hit that chip shot, the people just ran in front of the green. And I would guess that I had to walk through 7 people, 8 people. So there were 7 or 8 deep around the 18th green. And there were grandstands all around the green. So, I would guess maybe 6 to 10,000 people. It's a wild guess.
I take it, like yourself, for them, Gary Player's the hero. He's the one they're all behind here.
Not really, eh? Because I was the underdog, and I was the kid. So a lot of people, it was quite nicely split.
And how was Gary with you? Because here you are, the youngster. Here's a guy who, a couple of years earlier, is the Masters champion, the Open champion, won 8 majors at this point already.
Gary was always fine with me. We had our ups and downs and stuff like that, but Gary was always fine.
I mean, at this point, though, yeah,
he was fine with me.
Yeah,
it was.
During the round, was there any no gamesmanship at all, or
not
anything
at all.
Like that?
Not at all. No, certainly not that I noticed. And a lot of people would say that Gary did that to them, but I certainly never noticed it. And Gary, I think, was a lot more worried about a fellow by the name of Bobby Cole, because Bobby Cole was a beautiful golfer. I got results, but I was never a classic golfer. And I think Gary was a little more worried about Bobby not getting off his mantle than he was about me, even though I'd beaten him a few times.
Yeah.
I think he thought that Hayes is a bit lucky. I don't think he was as worried about it as he was about Bobby. But as I say, I don't think on that chip shot, I don't think I've ever been quite so nervous. Anyway, I managed to chip the ball about 5 feet away. And Dennis Hutchinson, now as I say, they were doing testing of television, okay? And Dennis Hutchinson was commentating. It was like one of his first tournaments that he ever commentated, probably the first tournament that he ever commentated on. And Dennis Hutchinson will tell you the story how nervous he was when I hit that chip shot and when I had that putt. And again, Gary Player from the back of the green, 20 foot above the hole, downhill putt, a fast putt in those days. Now, that was before being grass greens, so it wasn't fast by today's standard, but a fast putt in those days. And he left the ball that much in the middle of the hole short.
So like one roll away.
One roll, and it could never have missed. Okay? And, Gary just walked down, his head was down like this, and he walked down like this, and you could see how disappointed he was. He never lifted his head, he just like this, and he walked up, and he tapped it in. And he walked across to the side of the green, and he never lifted his head. He was just like this. Because I suppose going back at what had happened earlier in that round, the way I'd played,
sure.
He thought, well, there's no way he's going to miss that putt. And, well, thank goodness I didn't miss the putt. But I think the point of it was that I hit 11 fairways in 2 rounds, the final 2 rounds, and I shot 66-66.
That's amazing.
Hitting 11 fairways. Gary Player stood up in his speech and he said, I have never seen anybody play worse golf and win a tournament than I've seen over the last 36 holes. Well, I couldn't resist it. I said, it's lovely to know that I can play bad golf and still beat Gary Player. Which didn't go down well, as you can imagine.
A couple of things I'm picking up here. One is you're talking about your game and you're kind of putting it down, but yet here's a guy who's not his best, shot 66 to win a tournament against an 8-time major winner, one of the heroes of your country in terms of golf. So they're kind of like a paradox here.
I think that's why when you got in touch with me and asked me to pick a round, that's why I picked this round, because I was always so proud of the fact that I could win a tournament playing bad golf. Now, and when I talk about bad golf, I'm obviously talking about tee to green.
Sure.
I'm not talking about around the greens. Around the greens, I was a genius. Around the greens, it was just ridiculous.
Was that your game would you say, or was that just a one-off?
My game, contrary to what a lot of people will tell you, the nearer I got to the hole, the better I got. I was never a great driver. When I drove the ball well, my results were usually good. And the nearer I got, so my short irons were good, my pitching was good, my bunker shots were good, my chipping was good. My chipping now is, no, we don't even discuss it anymore, okay? So don't get any bright ideas, okay? But
don't worry, I'll leave that alone.
The nearer I got to the greens, the better I got. Now, so I was a little bit used to it, but I was that particular week, I was particularly bad with my long game.
Because I've read somewhere that you were a guy of limited self-belief. That's what I'm hearing a little bit of from when you're talking about your time in America, you're talking about your time in the build-up to this event. I mean, as I say, I look at your resume at this point, and you've won a couple of times in Europe, you've gone to America, you've won on the Sunshine Tour, you've beaten Gary Player. I mean, your chest should be puffed out and feeling top of the world.
You know, it was strange. You know, I like to blame the fact that we never had television. And maybe that's just a kind of a way out for me, okay? Because I never got to see, or we never got to see, our age group of players in South Africa. That's the Bayokis, the Blands, that group of players. Never got to see the top Americans play week in and week out. We saw them at the Open Championship. That was about it. So we were very intimidated, and I was very intimidated by the top American players. You know, American players, as far as I was concerned, were the elite.
But you've just beaten Gary Player three times, and he's the guy that beats them on their own patch.
It's weird. When I got to the Open, I was completely intimidated. I never thought I could win the Open.
Yeah, because I've looked at your major record. You had one top 20 at the Masters and a couple of top 20s at the Open.
Yeah.
So, I mean, nothing bad about that, but compared to what you were doing elsewhere.
And an interesting conversation around the Open, 1974, I played a practice round at Royal Lytham with Warren Humphreys. And I was playing some of the best golf that I'd played. I finished second in the Order of Merit to Peter Roosthuis in 1974. And so I was playing some terrific golf. And I played a practice round with Warren. And I'll never forget this, because Warren said to me, he said, you know, Hazy, he said, you know, you can win this Open. And I just burst out laughing. He said, what are you laughing at? I said, how can I win this Open, man? The Americans are here. And I'll never forget that conversation.
Looking back, do you think you were beating them before you started?
Oh, yeah. No question about it. No question. And, you know, It's crazy because, you know, you mentioned paradoxes earlier. And it's crazy, you know, because I went over to America as a junior golfer. So I started traveling, playing golf when I was 16 years old.
And you won the World Junior
And the first tournament I played in was the Orange Bowl Junior. And I got into the playoff and I lost in the playoff. And then I went to the World Junior and won the World Junior. So, you know, I shouldn't have been intimidated by the Americans, but no. I was.
And
I was
also the other thing that interests me is, and I'll bring up your dad now, Otway, because, you know, he was a famous character in South Africa as well. Before we talk about what he did and how that influenced you, surely, I mean, I don't know what your relationship was like, but wouldn't that be a shoulder to lean on and to maybe talk through that kind of intimidation that you were feeling?
I don't think he ever realised it. I don't think he ever realised it. I think my father was probably very surprised at my lack of success when I went to America. I think he was very surprised. I think he really expected me to do a lot better because the golf courses suited me a lot better than the British golf courses.
And also, people would have thought, well, he turns up in South Africa, he wins there. He turns up in Europe, he wins there. Off he goes to America, surely going to do the same thing.
Yeah. And I think he was very surprised. I think he was actually shocked at how badly I did. I'm exaggerating about how badly I did, but I think he was shocked that I didn't do better. But I think he also understood that it just wasn't my kind of lifestyle. Because, you know, once I came back from America, I came back to play in Europe in 1978. I won the first two tournaments that I came back to. I won the French Open, Italian Open. I won two in a row.
And can I just say, you won the French Open by 11 shots.
Yeah, but that's, you know, I beat a fellow by the name of Seve Ballesteros.
Yeah, so he wasn't much, was he?
But he was only 6 years old at the time.
Hold on, Seve was already European number one.
And no, I'm kidding.
He was about to lift the claret jug.
That's right.
I mean, that's remarkable. I mean, to win a tournament as prestigious as the French Open, one of the oldest national opens as well, to win it by so many shots, to beat the calibre of someone like Seve in second place.
Yeah, you know, but again, you know, I could tell you a story about that because, again, it's weird because even though I'd won that tournament, I'd won it by 11 shots, I'd won it by miles. I could tell you on the 18th tee, the 18th hole at this golf course, there was water on the left-hand side, there was out of bounds on the right. And I walked onto the 18th tee and I thought to myself, you know, if I hit 4 shots either into the water or out of bounds, then I better start to panic. Now, how can a thought like that even go through your mind when you're winning a French Open by 11 shots? It can't go through your mind.
You would think that would be the furthest thing from your
exactly.
mind.
Exactly. You'd think I'm 11 shots ahead, I'm gonna birdie this hole and finish 12 shots ahead and off I go. That's the way you'd think you would be thinking.
Sure.
But it's not always the way.
We mentioned your dad there, Otway. He was the first person to beat Bobby Locke for 20 years in South Africa.
That's
right?
Yes. My dad was he was pretty amazing because he came here to this golf club where we're sitting right now, Swartkop, in Pretoria. He came from Cape Town, and he came here because he wanted to be able to practice golf in better weather. So he came here as the club professional, went away to the war, came back straight off the war to this golf club, and was here for 56 years as the pro. 56 years, he never changed his job. And he brought us up, the three brothers. My eldest brother was a very fine player as well. My eldest brother, John, won the Australian amateur. He won the Rhodesian amateur. He won the South African amateur. He won the German amateur. So, I mean, he could seriously play golf.
Sure.
He played as a pro for a short time, but hated the travelling. And that was a huge disappointment to my dad because he really was a terrific player. And, you know, it was quite interesting because John was, he was a really nice guy, but he was very tough on me. So for me, I was 10 years younger. So for me to play golf with him, you know, was like something really special. But I mean, he would do things on the golf course to me. He would penalize me for every single thing. He would stand on my ball. He would do all sorts of things. He would hide my golf ball, and all because he wanted me to be tougher than him, because he realized that he was never tough enough.
Do you think that's why you were the champion at 18?
I'm sure that contributed to it. I'm sure that...
Obviously, that did, talent and...
Yeah. No, I'm sure that did contribute because I was a lot tougher than he was. I think winning was more important to me than it was to both he and my dad. You know, my dad obviously was a fine player. The fact that he beat Bobby Locke...
What's incredible is no one beat Bobby Locke for 20... So Bobby Locke played in South Africa. I mean, that must have been a lot of events over a period of 20 years.
It's unbelievable.
And Bobby Locke won every single one apart from that time your dad beat him.
Well, Bobby Locke won the South African Open as a teenager in 1935. And the 1955 South African Open was played right here. And between those two, so for 21 years, he never ever lost a South African Open that he played in. He played 9 and won 9. Now, obviously, you had the war years as well.
Sure, yeah,
and then a couple of the years he missed because he was in America. But every single South African Open he played in, he won.
Were you alive when your dad beat him?
I was just born.
Okay, so you don't remember
it. I was just born. I had I didn't have any idea. And funny enough, my father very rarely spoke about it until I actually asked him. You know, until we asked him about it, then he would tell us. And what had actually happened was they were all square on the 17th hole. And the 17th, they played a golf course called Kensington. And the 17th, my dad headed onto the front of the green. He had about a 50-foot putt. And he said he walked onto the green. And he said there were so many people. And all he wanted to do was not make a fool of himself, you know, by doing something stupid. That's all he wasn't even thinking about winning. Because you didn't beat Bobby Locke.
No, he was untouchable.
It didn't happen. So he wasn't it never entered his head that he was going to beat him. Even on the 17th when he was all square. And he had this 50-foot putt, and he was thinking to himself, just don't make a fool of yourself. Don't do anything stupid. And he hit this putt, and this ball went in. And he said he couldn't believe it. He said the crowd went absolutely crazy. And he couldn't believe what had happened. And on the 18th hole, we used to have this photograph at our house. My father hit the green in two, and he putted it down. And his ball is lying that far from the hole. And the photograph is Bobby Locke has just hit his putt. And his ball has finished inside my dad's ball. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And my dad tells the story that as Bobby Locke hit the putt, he said the ball hadn't gone 2 yards. Bobby Locke turned his back on the ball, walked across to my father, and said, congratulations, Otway. Good luck in the final.
Amazing.
He knew he'd missed it, and yet his ball was less than 10 inches from the hole. But he knew he'd missed it.
Obviously, that's the guy who, you know, from your dad's perspective, no one better than Bobby Locke. You played with Gary Player, took him on, beat him. I know you played Tom Watson. Did you play with Jack Nicklaus?
Yes.
Obviously, Seve, we've just spoken.
Yeah.
Who of those to you was the most special? Who was the most talented?
Well, I still believe that Jack Nicklaus is the greatest player that's ever lived. And I believe that because I think that his record in the majors is simply incredible.
But when you played with him, I mean, was he special to watch, to be alongside?
Yes. No, he was. I played the first two rounds of the Australian Open with him. And he shot 62 in the first round. I shot 72. And when I walked off, I thought I shot 90. That's what it felt like. It felt like I just had the worst round of golf. And I came in, I thought, well, you know, that's not bad. I shot 72, you know. So I played the first two rounds with him, and he was absolutely incredible. The way he managed himself on the golf course was special. He had such incredible course management. He had decided how to play the golf course before he got there. And he didn't vary it. You know, if he was going to hit a 3-wood off a tee or an iron off a tee or hit his drive to the right or hit his drive to the left or whatever, that's the way he played the golf course. He'd worked it out, and that's the way he played. And, you know, if something happened that wasn't so good or something happened that was especially good, straight thereafter, he went back into that mode and carried on playing the golf course the way he'd planned. He was incredible as far as I was concerned. I played then the first two rounds of the Open Championship at Muirfield when he had a chance of winning the Grand Slam. And I played the first two rounds of the Open Championship at Royal Liverpool and St. Anne's. And then I played a round with him in a tournament in America. So I played seven tournament rounds with him, and I played a practice round with him. So I played 8 rounds of golf with Jack Nicklaus. And as I say, in my opinion, nobody is better than him. I think Tiger Woods has played better golf than him. I think Tiger Woods at his best played the best golf that's ever been played.
What about when you saw this young Spaniard show up?
Seve.
Yeah.
Seve Ballesteros played his first tour in South Africa in 1974. And the first time that I saw him was about 2 months before that at the Italian Open in Venice. And his brother was talking about him, saying, yeah, he's the next world champion. And his brother he didn't mince his words. So I kind of saw him practice that at the Italian Open. I saw him hit shots on the practice team. And then at the end of 1974, Bobby Cole and I won the World Cup of Golf in Venezuela, and I came back to play a tournament in Cape Town, the Western Province Open, and I got drawn in the final round with Seve, and he was 17. And as we walked off the 18th green, Manuel Ballesteros said to me, he said, my brother is going to be a champion, yes? And I couldn't disagree, because he was phenomenal. He really was. You could see it. You know, I've seen 3 young players who I realized straight away were different. Seve was the most noticeable. Greg Norman was next, and Nick Faldo. Those 3 players, for me, when I saw them as youngsters, were just different. They had some quality that made them, you know, that made them different, that you knew they were going to be superstars. And on those 3, I was right every time.
Yeah. Back to you and being a South African golfer in the 1970s, as you say, just television's just starting, traveling the world and what was going on in the country with apartheid. How awkward was that? Did you feel it? Did you notice it? Did you feel burdened by it?
Very much so. You know, I was a kid. I mean, I stopped playing when I was 28. So even,
well, we'll come to that in a moment. Yeah.
Even when I was 28, I was, I suppose, a kid.
Yeah, you were.
But I was, you know, I wasn't mature. I wasn't mature in the ways of the world. I certainly wasn't mature in anything to do with politics. I didn't have a clue. I mean, obviously I knew what apartheid was. I knew what the situation was in South Africa. I knew that the rest of the world didn't approve of what the South African government were doing.
How were you aware of that? By when you travelled, people
said? When I travelled, yeah. You know, I mean, straight away, as soon as you mentioned that you were from South Africa, you saw the person kind of go like this. And if they did question you, you know, the first question would be, how can you live with apartheid? You know, it would be the very first question that you would get. And a lot of countries were making it quite difficult for us to play.
So you couldn't travel to certain places and play?
Japan, you couldn't play. There were one or two other countries that you couldn't play. Sweden banned us in the middle late 70s. So you couldn't play in Sweden. So there were a number of places.
And did you ever have any protests against you at all?
We had a protest in France one year. And then I think it was the 1979 World Cup of Golf, Hugh Bayocchi and I played. And we went and played a couple of practice rounds. We played in the Pro-Am on the Wednesday. And we played in the morning. And at lunchtime, Hugh Bayocchi said, I'm just going off into town. I'll see you later. And I went out and I was practicing. And the organisers came across to me and they said, listen, we've got some very bad news, but you're not going to be able to play in the World Cup. Well, I just burst out laughing. I thought they were kidding me. I said, well, what do you mean you won't be able to play? You know, we're here. They said, well, unfortunately, the Greek government has been given an ultimatum by the African Union that if they allow South Africa to play, they're all going to boycott the Olympics. So, you know, in no time at all, the South African ambassador was there and we were having meetings. It was so far from my world, okay? The cocooned world that I lived in.
Sure.
That, you know, I really didn't even understand what was going on, I suppose you could say. Now, that might be a pathetic excuse. But it really, my mind wasn't... I was spending 8-9 months a year overseas, you know, playing golf all over the world. And I was just so far away from this that it was the biggest surprise, I think, of our lives.
So at that time, you're, as I say, feeling this tension, if you like, being South African. I mean, that must have been difficult to... Never mind being banned from a tournament. I mean, we can see there's that politics, an obvious politics situation going on. But from an individual perspective, I mean, did it weigh on you at all?
No, it didn't. I can't say that it did.
No.
You know...
Because, as you say, you ended up stopping playing at the age of 28 professionally.
And a lot of that was in the end, because in the last few years, I did feel it a little bit. But in those middle years, or the first few years that I played... It was...
So the naivety maybe was quite good for you in a way.
Oh, yeah, no question about it.
By the time you got to 28, maybe you were becoming more aware.
I was becoming much more aware of what was going on. I was becoming much more aware that we were starting to be banned. Holland were talking about banning us. France were talking about banning us. Australia were talking about it. I'd personally just had a problem in Brazil where... it was on the front page of the Brazilian, whatever the local newspaper was, that there was this racist guy from South Africa that was leading the Brazilian Open. And the gist of the story was that, you know, I was a racist because when I got onto the green, I didn't want to go anywhere near my caddy because he was of colour and I was throwing my ball for him to clean it. And I, you know, because I wouldn't go anywhere near him because he was a coloured guy. You know, it was ridiculous. But it was in the newspaper.
And people believe what they read.
Of course they do. And we were just being banned from playing in the World Cup of Golf. And the World Cup the next year were talking about not having us in the World Cup. So I felt that this was this sort of thing was starting, okay? And it upset me because I didn't feel that I was a racist. I certainly didn't feel that. I felt that no matter whether the guy was, whatever the person was, wherever he came from, whatever religion he was, whatever, I felt like I treated him the same.
But could you, I mean, as I say, it's hard for you within the cocoon, but were you able to comprehend why people might have that image of you being South African?
Absolutely. You know, if you come from a country that has a particular law, you know, in some way you've got to take responsibility for it. Whether that means that you have to decide to leave that country because you don't like that law, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is to that. I decided that I didn't have to. That was my decision.
Sure.
And, you know, I think what is interesting about South Africa, there's no question. There's no question when I look back on it now that the policies were so wrong. And they still are coming now to hurt us. Even today, 25 years later, you know, they are really hurting us. Because if we had 50 years before we had the change of government, if everybody in South Africa had been given the same opportunity of education, and I'm just talking about one thing,
mm-hmm.
of education, this country would be so much different today. I mean, they only are catching up now in terms of education.
Sure.
And that, for me, is the most hurtful thing about the apartheid government.
Sure. I'm talking to you because I just want an individual perspective, and you said that and I can understand why, it had some relation to you quitting professional golf life so early. What were the other reasons then?
You know, my father was a professional golfer at a golf club. So somewhere in the back of my mind, that has always kind of interested me. I think because I travelled, even though I'd only turned pro when I was 18, I'd travelled since I was 16, so I travelled for 12 years. And travel was hard, eh? Travel is hard.
Mm-hmm.
I think today it's probably even harder than it was in my time due to the security issues. But travel in those days was hard. You know, it wasn't a case of private planes or first class or business class or fancy motor cars and all that sort of thing. You know, it was buses, trains, tubes, all those kind of things.
How long would it take you to get from, say, South Africa to you know, let's say, eastern side of America?
Well, when I first went, my first time, I had to go through London. So that was 15 or 16 hours. Because you had to stop on the way to London. So you couldn't do that direct. And then it was a few hours in London and then on to New York. So the entire trip was probably somewhere in the middle 30s in hours.
Okay, so you were pretty much fed up of the lifestyle.
Yeah, I wasn't enjoying the lifestyle. I felt I'd done what I could do in golf, which was win tournaments. Okay, now this is where the major thing comes in, because I never felt I could win a major. And when I look back again, you know, I mean, it's quite ridiculous, because certainly in the middle 70s and 1978, in 1978, 1974, 1975, those 3 years, I felt like I played the golf that I could have won a major. Okay, it wasn't for a very long period of time, maybe, but I certainly felt I played the kind of golf where I could have contended in major championships.
Well, the stats back it up. You were one of those years the number one player in Europe.
Yeah, but in those days, I never felt like I could win a major. So I felt I'd done what I could do in golf. I'd won the kind of tournaments I could win. I'd won the French Opens, the Spanish Opens, the Italian Opens, the South African Opens. I'd won the World Cup, which was a bonus. I'd won those sort of tournaments. And, you know, that was what it was going to be. So if I carried on playing, it was going to be kind of more of the same. Whereas I thought I'd like to do something different.
What about the money?
The money wasn't there in those days.
So it wasn't a factor?
It wasn't a factor at all. Not in those days. The money started, the big money started probably 4 or 5 years after I quit. Then the guy started to earn good money.
Because you could have been part of that gravy train, couldn't you?
Oh, in the middle 80s, you know, if I carried on playing, yeah.
Did you look at that with a kind of jealousy?
I don't look back.
No.
Thank goodness, because I think I might have slashed my wrist if I'd done it. But I'm not the sort of person, once I make a decision, good or bad, that's it. I don't look back. And I'm very fortunate in that respect. So I've made some bad decisions. I've made one or two awful decisions. Okay, fortunately, I've made some good decisions. But those bad decisions have never bothered me for very long.
And going back to November 1976, it's a long time ago. How clear is that in your mind now? And when you were just talking about it, could you feel it? Can you?
Oh, yes. I mean, I can tell you that I can feel, I can almost feel what I felt like standing over that chip shot. I can feel what it was like standing over that putt. You know, I standing over that putt, I thought to myself, just keep still, okay? And the one lingering memory is after I'd hit the ball, I was looking straight down at that piece of grass down where the ball was, okay? And I looked up, and I promise you, the putt was 5 feet, and the ball only had that much to go when I looked up, and it went right in the middle of the hole. But I mean, I can still today remember looking down at that piece of grass as I hit that putt. I can still remember that today. I can remember afterwards who I took out to dinner to celebrate, which didn't go down very well because she was a lady that was still married to her previous husband. And my parents, I shouldn't be talking about, I'm sure, but we had a judge who played golf at our golf club here at Swatcom. And my parents were very, very unhappy. And they got the judge to come and speak to me that this was not the right thing for me to be doing. So I remember exactly how I celebrated that night. So I remember that vividly.
Love, politics, and a career that may have only spanned 10 years, but Del Hayes fitted in enough memories over that period to last a lifetime. To many of us, cutting short a career that may have had so much more to offer might seem a waste. But Dale revels in his lifestyle at Zwartkop Country Club in Pretoria, a home to his family, for nearly 80 years. Next week on The Round, it's Scott Hend and a breakthrough on the European Tour at the age of 41 at the Hong Kong Open and a playoff where his opponent threw him off his guard.
And then we're walking off a tee and the strangest thing was said to me, and I turned to Angela and I said, oh man, how good is this? He goes, oh, this is great, I don't mind coming second. And I just sat there and looked at Tony and went, I don't know if that was a nervousness from Angelo saying that or whether he was trying to subconsciously get me thinking another way, but you don't have to say things like that to me. I judge my career at the end by how many wins I've had, not by how many times I've lost in a playoff.
Hend talks about the injury and health problems that blighted his time on the PGA Tour, his battle with his temper, his relationships, his philosophies, and how, as a teenager, perceived derogatory comments from one of Australia's best-known coaches acted as huge motivation throughout his career.
Thank you for listening to The Round with Richard Kaufman. You can follow us and get in touch via Twitter at The Round Podcast, on Instagram, Podcast The Round, and on Facebook at The Round Richard Kaufman. And we'd appreciate you taking the time to rate and review us on iTunes. The Round Podcast with Richard Kaufman, in association with IMG Audio.